Ready.
Okay, the recording is live. Rabbi Cohen, you have the floor.
Yeah, thank you very much. We'd like to start on time. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to Home Court Advantage, because tonight we have Rabbi Moshe Kurtz from Agudat Shalom. Last week we were blessed to have Rabbi Noah Chessis from Sharon. And God willing, next week, I believe Rabbi Benjamin Samuels. Is that correct?
From that is the lineup, Rabbi Samuels, then Rabbi Brander, then yourself.
There you go. I'm looking forward to it. So it's really wonderful to bring everybody together virtually, to bring our New England communities together. And we have the fortune this evening to hear from our new assistant rabbi, Rabbi Moshe Kurtz, who was instrumental in making this program happen. He's jumped in with 2 feet and more over the past number of months, coming to our community in a challenging time, but really being very proactive about meeting people, initiating new programs, strong pastoral support. And it's really wonderful to have you and Marissa in Stanford with us. And we bless you and Marissa with continued hatzlacha in our community in the years ahead. So without further ado, I want to thank Rabbi Kurtz. I also want to acknowledge the president of Agudat Shalom, who is here, Toby Schaefer. Good to see you for your inspiration. Adult education, you know, sometimes presidencies, they are accentuated by what the passion is of the particular president. So Toby Schaefer is very into adult education. So under her leadership, we're seeing a flowering of even more educational opportunities. So thanks for keeping your eye on the growing Torah opportunities.
All because of you and Rabbi Kurtz.
Thanks. Okay. So without further ado, Rabbi Kurtz, thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Thank you, Toby. And in addition to all the people who I usually get to see on my Monday night lecture, I want to acknowledge the presence of all these new faces that I'm seeing here. So perhaps some people from our community, some people from our greater New England community that are joining us. So thank you for taking a time to join us to learn some Torah this evening. And I hope that the topic will be intriguing and insightful. So what is our topic? I'm sure that's what we saw when we were logging on. It's, I think, something like guns, violence, and a weaponry. Jewish approach. What was the exact title, Phyllis?
Weaponry.
And weaponry, great. Or in other words, what's the relevance to Hanukkah? So let's address the elephant in the room. While of course there's a lot of very positive ideas that surround Hanukkah about the lights, about the oil that was found, the greater background of what's happening here is that there is something that could be termed, depending on your ideology, a form of fundamentalism that can be taken away. So when Rabbi Chessis spoke last week, he highlighted that there's different approaches to Hanukkah. Do we focus on more the religious, on the oil? Do we focus more on the military victory? And Rambam, among others, focus, at least partially, on the military might of the Jewish people. And the question that has really not troubled me, but something that I've been thinking about, that I've been contemplating, is what is an authentic Jewish approach to guns, to weaponry, to war? So this question is fundamentally a question of disposition. It's a question of attitude. But the way we're going to ground ourselves this evening is by looking through a few Jewish legal questions regarding guns, regarding weapons, in order to derive a greater Jewish philosophy from there. So just to give a little bit of a preview, there will be some Hilchos Shabbos, there will be other areas of halacha, and there'll be a very interesting question at the end where we ask a question: if when you buy a new rifle, do you make a Shechianu on it?
Hi.
So that's a question that was asked in Israel. And as you can imagine, in America, this is a question for us because some people are proud gun owners. Some people do not want gun ownership, and we don't need to get into the politics of the matter. But in Israel, it's very much inseparable. Rabbis have to address this question. So that's something that we're going to look at later on. The Israeli sources are the most telling because they really, it's not just an abstract question that, you know, let's get together on a Monday evening and talk about these questions. In America, it is a question, but in Israel, it's that much more compounded. So before we look at the source sheet, I want to ask you a question. So who built the first temple? Which king was responsible for that?
Shlomo.
King Shlomo. Okay, Phyllis, we can always rely on you. I know you have your Tanakh in hand. So let me ask you a question. That's odd. Why was Solomon, Shlomo, the son of King David, the one who built the temple? I would think King David, you know, we don't sing. When we sing David Melch Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, not Shlomo. So he if David, King, one moment, if King David is so great, why is it that his son built the temple and God did not enable King David to build the temple?
He was too involved with war.
Oh, okay, Bruce. So, okay, good. So you're already jumping onto the topic here. He was too involved with war. Can anyone elaborate on that?
He sent Bathsheba's husband to the front.
Ah, very good, Jenny. So another idea that's brought up is that David was a very righteous person, but he did commit some very significant sins that Chazal, the rabbis, do try to sugarcoat a little bit. But if you read the Bible, you read Tanakh, they are there. So those are, anyone have a third possibility? Well, okay. So let's go to our first one for a moment. Let me share the screen. I'll share with you my source sheet. Everyone do me a favor, just everyone mute themselves. And if and when you have a question, you can unmute for that. But let me just present the first part here first. And my goal really is this shiur, this class is split into different sections, divided into different sections. And what I'm going to try to do is at the end of each section to take questions, take input. If something's very unclear, then let me know. Otherwise, just write down the question and God willing, we will get there. Okay, so when you look over here, you look in Chronicles, you look at Divrei HaYamim. In Divrei HaYamim, it says as follows. Let me zoom in a little bit so we can see more clearly. Vayomer David l'Shlomo, b'ni ani haya im levavi livnos b'ayis Hashem Adonai l'hai. Shlomo, my boy, Shlomo, my son, I wanted to build a temple to the Lord our God. But what happened? Vayhi alai dvar Adonai le'mor. But God came to me and he said, Dom larov shafachta, you spilled much blood. Umelchamos gedolos asisa, and you've waged great wars. Lo sivna bayis lishmi, ki domim rabim shafachta artsa lefanai. You cannot be the one to build the temple for me because you have spilled much blood. And when you look in the Metsudas David, he says, this is connected to an idea that's earlier, that's found in the five books of Moses, which is the idea of that there's a prohibition, Lahanif Barzel al Mizbeach, that when they wanted to construct the Mizbeach, the altar in the temple or in the tabernacle of God, they were not allowed to use a metal implement to do that. And because of that, we have this whole lore about the Shamir worm, had this like acid that came out of its mouth, and that's how they had... how they had to cut things down, cut down the stones in the temple, but they weren't allowed to use metal. Why? Because metal is used for swords. It's used for weapons. And since it is used for weapons, how can you bring that into the house of God? And so the, I would say probably the earliest source that you find this in is in the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. Taniyatic source. It says as follows. I didn't find a translation for it, but I'll translate as I go along. Rabbi Shimon Elazar Omer, Hamizbeach Nivra Laharech Shnosav Shol Adam, the altar was created to lengthen the years of man on this earth. Vahabarzel Lekatzir Shnosav Shol Adam, but barzel, the iron, the metal, that was created to shorten man's life on this earth. Therefore, Eino Rashai Lohanif Amakatzir Almarech. You can't bring that which is designated to destroy and to shorten man's life upon the altar, which is there to lengthen man's life. Ein kateger nazis aneger. It's a similar idea. Therefore, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai Omer, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Harehu Omer avanim shlemos tivna avanim shematilo shom. What's it mean to build avanim shlemos? Build stones that create shalom, that create peace. By Varei Dvarim Kalvachomer. If we're so concerned, even for an altar found in God's temple that doesn't see, it can't listen, it can't speak, it's inanimate. That you can't put metal on because you can't associate that with war and with destruction. Hamato shalom bein ish le ishto, bein ear le ear, bein uma le uma, bein menshala le menshala, bein mishpacha le mishpacha. Someone who puts peace between a man and his wife, between a city and a city, a nation and a nation, and a government and government, and family and family. Alachas kama v'kama shol tavo ala puranos. Certainly for them, they are praiseworthy. And what we see here is that God said weapons, even metal, which is not a sword, but it's being used for a good purpose, that has no place inside my temple. That has no place inside the synagogue. And if you look over here in the Shulchan Aruch as well, the Shulchan Aruch says this isn't just a nice midrashic idea. You know, it's not just like a Saturday Shabbos morning sermon that you give and you say, okay, we have to have shalom. So therefore, metal is not brought upon the altar. Metal is not brought in the temple of God. There are actual legal halachic ramifications. The Shulchan Aruch rules in accordance with this and says, therefore, yesh osim lichanes bo besakin aruch barosh magula. One is not able to enter into the synagogue. You're not allowed to come into synagogue with a sword, a long sword that is revealed. Because how can you come into the temple of God or the synagogue of God, a mikdash ma'at, while you are praying to lengthen your years, to lengthen the years of your loved ones? Meanwhile, you're sitting with a sword, which you use to shorten someone's years. At very least, it's not a good optic, but it actually has legal issues as well. So that's the problem with David HaMelech, with King David. That King David, maybe, you know, look, he waged God's wars. King David did nothing wrong. He was doing the right thing. He was supposed to wage God's wars. He was supposed to capture Israel. The way he went about doing it, we can ask questions. But since his hands became associated with violence and with destruction, it couldn't be the same hands that would be used to build the temple, to build the Mishkan. That's what the Metsudas David says. And that there is a Radak that has this idea that David HaMelech, it wasn't actually an issue. You know, I was going to say for later, but I'll just share it now briefly as a footnote, and then I'll take questions. So the Radak says, whoa, let's take a step back. If David HaMelech, if King David, was following the will of God, he was following God's dictates, and God said to wage war, how can he be to blame? How could God hold that against him that he listened to Hashem's will? If anything, he was performing a mitzvah. If anything, that should give him the right to build God's temple. But the Radak and others mention that it is possible if you look at David HaMelech's campaigns, he did spill unnecessary blood. It's possible that there was collateral damage. It's possible that he could have prevented additional damage to civilians. But because he wasn't so concerned for that, that's what God held against King David, which is interesting. If anyone has ever read Rav Schechter in his book, Be'ikvei Hatzon, Rav Herschel Schechter has a whole essay about giving away land for peace in the state of Israel. And he takes a very hardline position saying that you cannot give up any land, even in theory, if you know it will ensure some form of peace. And in that essay, in a footnote, he takes a hardline position and says that even civilians who are on the side of the enemy also have the same status as the enemy, which would be at odds with this Radak. Because the Radak here is saying, actually, there's nuance. When there's combatants, you fight the combatants. David HaMelech, King David, he went a step further. He went ahead and he did not ensure that his soldiers did not kill non-combatants. So it's interesting. There is a huge dispute as to how the Jewish state, how a Jewish army is supposed to relate to non-combatants. There is an argument that even if you are not officially on the battlefield, but if you are supporting the war effort of a Jewish enemy, that makes you also a Jewish enemy. It's tantamount to being on the battlefield. But some say it's bad, but it doesn't make them a combatant. And so that's one of the details that comes out from here. But if you look at this whole entire, this little conversation, this little monologue from King David to his son Shlomo, it really reads like weapons are not a good thing. Weapons are bad. They don't belong in the temple. They don't belong in the Mishkan. They don't belong in the presence of God. So I want to just pause right now. Is there any questions on what we mentioned so far? Anyone who hasn't had a chance yet to...
I do have a question.
Okay, well, let's just see. Does anyone else have any input or any points that they would like to bring up first? Okay, Phyllis, you're on.
So, short question. So no metal was allowed until the Beis HaMikdash was built, but it was allowed on the Mizbeach after the Beit HaMikdash was built.
If you're saying you're going to find that there's different pieces, if you analyze different tools in the temple, you will find some metal in there.
The Kohen did the Shechita. The sacrifices.
Right. So there seems to be something specific. If you look in the language of the Mechilta, is that it seems to be about the altar itself. That the altar, since it's there to lengthen the life, there's something very specific about the altar itself. That it would be hypocritical might be the wrong word, but at odds with the theme of the altar, that it should be made by using metal as well. So that's but I get your larger point. Similar idea with gold as well, the gold from the Egel Azov, the gold from the golden calf. You know, you'll still find golden things throughout temple worship. So it's a similar idea there. Okay. So now, Let's just move ahead a little bit. So one halachic sugya that is relevant here that we started to touch on, we're not going to get too much into the details, is that you're not allowed to bring a sword into shul. You need a chop of minyan. Many times it happens these days. You're running to minyan and then you realize you forgot your mask. You got to run back to the car and grab your mask. So similar idea, just the opposite. You run to shul, you have your sword on, you're like, oh, I have to go back to the car, put my sword in there, and then I can go into shul. The thing is, though, again, a question that comes up very frequently in Israel, but no reason it can't come up in the United States for a shul where they want to have congregants who are armed. The question is, can I bring a firearm into shul for security purposes? And I'm not dictating policy or anything right now, because each shul needs to determine what makes the most sense for them. But from a theoretical standpoint, if a shul determines it's right for their community to have a firearm, then what about from a halachic standpoint? Even if, you know, we determine that makes the most sense for my community, am I allowed to walk into shul with a firearm on? If I can just remind everyone to mute if you're not muted. Thank you.
So Moshe, the sword thing, though, the sword, it said you can't bring a sword in if you don't have it wrapped up. It didn't say you couldn't bring it in if it was wrapped up.
Very good. So thank you, Willie. So in the Tzitz Eliezer, among many other sources, they say, oh, you could wrap it up. But wrapping up is just mitigating, meaning because I wrap it up, out of sight, out of mind. But that acknowledges what I'm trying to derive from here is not so much how we poskim, but what is the general attitude towards weapons? Even if I am willing to say, you know what, you could come to shul with a firearm, with your rifle, but you need to put like a covering over. You need, like, instead of a talus bag, you have your rifle case, and you put your rifle in the case. That means the same message, the same principle is at play. That means it's still inappropriate to have a firearm in God's sanctuary, and by covering up, that's a way of mitigating that. But it acknowledges the principle that that's still an issue. And that's really what the Tzitz Eliezer does over here. We're not going to read the whole thing inside, but Rav Eliezer Woldenberg, we're talking 20th century now, he's addressing the question in Israel about people bringing firearms into shul. And he says, he gives a whole laundry list of ways to mitigate it. You know, maybe you could leave it outside, but if you need to bring it in, maybe don't have the magazine in the rifle, or at least don't have ammunition in the magazine. And he gives an entire list of ideas of how to mitigate the issue. But at the end of the day, he says, Al kishim tzav matzav kenisgar v'chayel v'ish ha-mishmar omdim ha-mishmeres ha-bitachon If you have someone who's there and you need it for security purposes, Ein lasser klal achar akal kal tchila. Don't start playing these games of, well, maybe I could cover it, maybe I could take out the ammunition. If the reason you have a rifle to begin with is because, God forbid, a terrorist might come in, which unfortunately has happened too many times in Israel and in our history here in America as well, if your goal is to be able to react as fast as possible by taking all these different by taking all of these different measures to ensure that the gun is not present in there, you're really compromising the safety of the people. Therefore, he says, "V'chlal yish gam tzfar lomar shalachayil obe b'tzava keva v'chein l'shoter kavua l'idam haruba ha'ektach o ha'ektach nechshavim ke'echem ivagdeim shemalbushim." So another svara is that, let's say I'm not a civilian. Let's say I'm a police officer. Let's say I am a soldier. So he says that's a part of my malbush, that actually when I have this, when I'm wearing a rifle, when I am wearing a handgun, it's actually a part of my clothing. So therefore, it's not considered an offense to bring into God's temple, but actually it would be permissible because that is a normal part of what I wear. That's a normal part of my clothing. Now, this is like a middle approach, which again, it acknowledges that ideally we shouldn't have to have the weapons here, but in the end of the day, if we need it for extenuating circumstances, for safety, then you could bring it in if it is necessary. That's Tzitz Eliezer's approach. And what this is really based on is another question. I'll take questions after this section. I just want to cover a little ground here. Another question that comes up is not about bringing a sword into shul, but what about carrying on Shabbos? So, first of all, mazel tov to everyone who's learning Daf Yomi on finishing Erevin. A question that is basically what Erevin consists of is circumventing the issue of Hotzah, the prohibition to carry outside of your personal domain on Shabbos. So here's the thing. If I'm not allowed to carry on Shabbos, why am I allowed to wear a shirt? Why am I allowed to wear a hat? Why am I allowed to wear a suit jacket or a tallis? The answer is, as many of us can intuit, that what I wear, my shirt, my tie, my glasses, my yarmulke, they are basically considered a part of my body. They are tufel. They are subsumed in the status of my body. It's not considered carrying when I wear a shirt or when I wear my glasses. There is a question about watches, interestingly enough, depending, is it more of an accessory or do you wear it more as a tool? So I think in Lakewood, actually, when the Erev is down, they hold not to wear a watch on Shabbos because the watch, they view it as more of a utility than as an accessory, as a part of one's clothing. So this question comes up, not for a hand watch, but for weaponry back in the times of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says as follows: Lo yotza ish, lo besayif, lo bekeshes, lo betris, lo ba'alav, lo b'romeach. A person shouldn't go out with a sword, with the bows and shields and all the kinds of weapons you can think of. And if you do, v'im yotza chayiv katas, if you do, you violated the prohibition of carrying outside the Erev on Shabbos. However, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, no, you haven't violated any prohibition. If you have the scabbard and you have the sword that is sheathed and you're wearing the sword as an ornament, tachshit in heinlo. The sword is an ornament. The sword is something that enhances your clothing. So his attitude, Rabbi Eliezer's attitude towards the weapons, was that sometimes people will wear a ceremonial sword, they will wear certain weapons on their clothing, and it's not like they're carrying the weapon. It's not there only as a utility, but similar to a watch, it's there as an accessory as well. That's what Rabbi Eliezer contends. But the Chachamim, the rabbi's responses to Rabbi Eliezer is what's very telling. The Chachamim Omrim, no, you're saying the weapons are tachshitin? They are an accessory? They are an ornament? They are a beautification? No. Einon ela lignai. No, they say that it's disgusting. It's reprehensible. How can you be proud of wearing the weapon? And they quote the famous verse that everyone loves to say, and we say it in the prayers for the state on Shabbos, if you do that in your shul. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not raise sword against nation, neither will they learn war anymore. So what we see from that verse is that what's the ideal? How do we conceive of utopia? Utopia is where we don't have swords and spears anymore. It's where we have just farming implements that we can use to live in a peaceful society. So the Chachamim, they are aghast. They say to Rabbi Eliezer, how can you say tachshitin heinlo, that they are an ornament? Weapons are not ornaments. They might be a necessary evil, but they are an evil nonetheless. Therefore, they cannot be considered part of one's clothing. You can't wear it on Shabbos. And if you do, it's carrying a tool. You violated carrying on Shabbos, even if you are wearing it as an ornament. And this is what the Shulchan Aruch posits as well. It's not just in the Mishnayos, but if we go to the Halachic codes, this is what the Shulchan Aruch says as well. Hilkach, lo yatz ish lo besayif, lo bekeshes, lo betris, lo ba'ah, lo beromeach, lo bekem she'em tachshit. He essentially quotes the Mishnah almost verbatim. And the Shulchan Aruch, the code of law, says that one is not allowed to wear those on Shabbos. And even if one tries to wear it as a piece of clothing, as an article of clothing, weapons are not clothing. They're not ornaments. Rather, they might be a tool, a necessary tool, but they do not come close to being an ornament. And what we're basically seeing until this point is a very negative portrayal of weaponry. What we're seeing from these sources so far, if I were to stop the class right here, is that at very best, Judaism sees weapons as a necessary evil, and to the extent that you can't even call it a part of your clothing, you should not be proud of wearing it. You have it when necessary, but that's all that it is. It's not an ideal, it's a necessary evil. If I were to stop the class right here, that would be the takeaway.
But isn't that just for Shabbos that it's talking about right here?
Ah, so Phyllis, very good. So now, while what we are doing right now is we are looking at a few halachic questions here. But what I want to derive again from these sources is the general attitude of our tradition toward weapons. So since the rabbi, why are the rabbis saying you can't carry the weapon on Shabbos? Now, by the way, by carrying, it doesn't mean literally carrying. The Aruch HaShulchan clarifies. It means shetolim bivgadav, that you are, it's hanging from your clothing. So you have the sword sheathed around and you have it on your belt. If you were literally carrying in your arm, if I was carrying a hand watch in my hand also, that would be considered carrying. So what we see from here, from this little technicality of a halakha, is a broader attitude of the rabbis. Why do they say you can't wear the sword on Shabbos? Because it's a genai, because it's reprehensible, because it's not something to be proud of. So what Rabbi, we see in halakha is the general attitude. Yes.
Well, how do we view how do we view Milchamet Mitzvah?
Ah, very good. So that's going to be Rav Neventhal we're going to see in a moment. But just to answer your question for a moment about Milchamet Mitzvah, you tell me. We just looked at David HaMelech before. David HaMelech, King David, I would presume he was waging a Milchamet Mitzvah. Now, of course, if we know a little bit of history behind Kedusha Rishona, Kedusha Shnia, and that whole topic, maybe King David went out of order. He should have captured Jerusalem before he started working on expanding the borders of Israel. That's a discussion. But that doesn't seem to be God's issue. God's issue with King David was that, look, you waged war. What can we do? And by the way, it's not a punishment to King David. It's just an objective problem. For instance, I think in one of my classes in the Shar HaGmul class on Thursdays, we learned about something called Tintum Halev. If someone eats non-kosher food, even if they do tshuva for it, there's this metaphysical idea that the non-kosher food just affects you either way. It's not that you, many times we think of sin as I committed this sin, God sees that I sinned, God looks through his list, his Rolodex of punishments, he says, okay, I'll pick that one to give him for that sin that he did. But many times, certain sins just have an inherent problem with them. There's something inherent within them. It's not God punishing me, but it's just that this act is intrinsically problematic. So eating non-kosher food, there's idea among the mystics that it has something called timtum halev, that even if you eat it by accident, you didn't mean to eat the non-kosher food, it still could affect you negatively in some sort of metaphysical way, which is beyond my pay grade to explain. But the idea here as well is that King David could have been following the rules. It could have been a Melchemes Mitzvah, as Dina pointed out. It could have been a war that was ordained by God. But by virtue of being involved in that war, you're not able to serve in the Beis Mikdash. Similar idea also. Think about a Kohen. If a priest, if he became Tame, it wasn't his fault, but he became spiritually impure. He somehow came in contact with a cadaver, with someone who passed away. It might not be his fault at all, but he still wouldn't be able to serve in the temple until he became purified. Certain things are just naturalistic. You stick your hand in the fire, you get burnt, whether you intended to stick your hand in it or not. Does that address your point, Dina?
Well, it seems with the concept of Melchemet Mitzvah, then it's not an absolute that weapons or war is wrong. It depends on the circumstances surrounding them.
Ah, so what you're saying is that, wait a minute, if war is such a bad thing, then why is that a huge mitzvah in the Torah to go conquer the land of Israel, to drive out the Canaanite nations? Seemingly, it shouldn't be as negative as I'm portraying it right now. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Okay, very good. So what I'm doing is just building up the first side of the argument, but as we will get to toward the end, I will reveal to us that there is another side to the argument. Otherwise, this would be a very straightforward and boring class. So just bear with me on that.
Very good.
Your intuition is correct, Dina. Was there another question? Okay. So one other area that this comes up in, again, is in Shabbos, but instead of talking about the issue of carrying, we're going to talk about the issue of muksa. You see, what makes something muksa? What makes something that I'm not allowed to use it on Shabbos? Why can't I move my TV on Shabbos? So the idea is that when something is muksa, it is literally, it's designated outside of Shabbos. Meaning if there's something that doesn't have a use on Shabbos, it becomes muksa because it has no use. So a question that came up was, wait a minute, so am I allowed to carry a firearm on Shabbos? Because really, I shouldn't be able to carry it on Shabbos, even within an Erev, because it's muksa, because it's used for killing, for shooting, for destruction, which is not permissible on Shabbos. So this was a question that Rav Shlomo Goren, the former chief rabbi of the IDF, received, and he gave a very resounding answer. He said, no. When it comes to Shabbos, we view this as a hutra, not as a dechuya. For instance, this is a whole sugya, but the basic background is that when I save someone's life on Shabbos and I have to drive a car, I have to drive them to the hospital, I didn't break one. This is machlokas, but the way he's portraying it is I didn't break Shabbos in order to save someone's life. In other words, not that Shabbos superseded, it's not that the pikuach nefesh, saving someone's life, superseded the prohibition of lighting a fire and driving on Shabbos, but rather when I drive on Shabbos, save someone's life, that's a part of Kiyum Shabbos. That's a part of upkeeping Shabbos because that person will be able to keep future Shabbos in the, God willing, the rest of his life. So what he says over here is, when we're talking about saving lives on Shabbos, this isn't dechuya, this isn't, oh, you know what, I have to break Shabbos. No, this is a hutra. It's completely permissible. When we're talking about defending our land, defending the country, the state of Israel, defending the Jewish lives and their homes from the enemy, they're not designated for a prohibition. Rather, they are being they're designated for permissible usage on Shabbos because they're being used to defend ourselves. And in the Shulchan Shomer, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach takes a similar approach too, where he says as well that you don't even have to take the bullets out of the rifle. The bullets aren't muksa. Now, according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, what's the point of having a rifle? He thinks that you're not going to come to use it on Shabbos, but even if you don't come to use the rifle on Shabbos, it still serves as a deterrent. That just by virtue of someone standing outside the shul with a rifle, that's going to make someone think twice before he starts up with the Jewish community. So it happens to be, even if someone never has to fire, and God willing, that should be the case, never has to fire that rifle on Shabbos ever in their entire career, ever in that shul's history, still, you can't say that the rifle is not serving a purpose. It serves a purpose because it acts as a deterrent. The fact that you've never had to use that rifle ever before may very well be a testament to its effectiveness at deterring people from starting up with the Jewish community. That's one short idea there. Now, I want to share two teshuvos. We're out of Hilchos Shabbos now. I would be remiss if I did not share the tshuva, the responsum of the Nota B'Yehuda. So Nota B'Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, he received a question, which really this tshuva is relevant to a number of topics, a few of them which I've covered in this Monday night class for those from Aguda Shalom who come to it. This came up when we talked about Tzar Balei Chaim, when we talked about about animals and torturing animals, animal cruelty towards animals. It came up when we were talking about Shomer B'Sayim Hashem, what kind of risk am I allowed to assume? When am I allowed to put myself in danger, what's called danger on Shabbos? The Nota B'Yehuda, he received the question from a Jew. He said, Rabbi, am I allowed to go hunting? Am I allowed to go hunting? Not for food, but for sport. Thank God, I live in Jewish community. I got ShopRite, I've got Grade A, I've got Beldadi's, I've got all these kosher establishments. I don't need to go hunting for kosher food. But, you know, as a pastime, I would love to go hunting. I love to find some deer to shoot. I love to go hunting for rabbit. Bears, whatever people go hunting for. As you can tell, I'm not a huge hunter myself. The question was, is a Jew allowed to go hunting? Before I give the answer to that question, what the Nota B'Yehuda says, what would you assume? Would you assume that a Jew is allowed to go hunting? I see a thumbs down over there.
Oh.
Okay.
No.
So, Janie, do you want to tell us why someone would not be allowed to go hunting? Since you gave us the thumbs down. Okay. Or does anyone else want to weigh in? Why would a Jew not be allowed to go hunting?
Why would you want to kill an animal needlessly?
Ah, okay. So let me throw it back
to you. Tzar Balei Chaim.
Tzar Balei Chaim. Oh, you know, this is very interesting, actually. So you're bringing up Tzar Balei Chaim, animal cruelty, right? Now, here's the thing, though. For those who were with us about 2 months ago, I won't hold you all accountable because many people here aren't from Aguda Shalom anyway. But for those who were with us on the Monday night class when we talked about veal, and we talked about that thing I still can't pronounce, faux gras, whatever it is, the stuffed ducks. Phyllis always corrects me on that. What was it? What was it, Phyllis?
Foie gras.
Foie gras. I can never do it. Okay, I can only speak American. Anyway, when we talked about that class, I actually omitted this source, saying I would save it for a later class. So here it is now. He actually says, Lo shayach tzar balei chaim. Against our intuition. I thought the same thing, by the way, when I first heard the question. Tzar Balei Chaim, the prohibition to be cruel toward animals needlessly, was what came to mind. But there's the key, therein lies the key term, needlessly. I'm not allowed to needlessly harm an animal. The thing is, one could argue, it may not be as essential as eating, but if I enjoy hunting and I have pleasure in shooting that moose and then mounting its head on top of my fireplace. I never actually seen anyone with that in their home, but I always see it in the movies at least. Maybe some of you have that. If I take joy in doing that, then that serves a purpose that at least on a halachic level, I'm allowed to do that. And what's really fascinating about this halachic responsum by the Nodi Yehuda is that he actually rejects all the reasons that you and I would think of. He says, it's not an issue of Tzar Bali Chaim. It's not an issue of Bal Tashchis, of needlessly destroying things for no good reason. Because again, you have a purpose. It may not be a purpose as central, as significant as hunting to eat, hunting to live, but hunting for recreation may also be a purpose of sorts. So you can't say that you're just needlessly killing animals. One could argue that recreation is important, and that's their form of recreation, and that's their need. And after, and the fascinating thing about this too is, after Nobi Huda, look at the intellectual honesty over here. He doesn't, he admits that there's no halachic issue, and he's willing to say that. He doesn't just marshal halach. Sometimes the way you know, I might be tempted to think is that if intuitively I think something's wrong, I then go about finding halachic sources to back up my intuition, my preconceived notion. But the Nobi Huda did the opposite, actually. He first said there's no halachic issue, and now he shares with us what his intuition on the matter is. This line over here, the highlight, literally the highlight. After he goes through a whole, I just gave an excerpt over here. After he goes through a whole arichas, a whole lengthy explanation of why it's not halachically problematic to go hunting for recreation, he says, but really, when I hear your question, I just don't understand where you're coming from. I can't understand this. When I look through the Torah and I think about who in the Torah is called an Ish Tzayed, we just saw this, Esau. Right? We just had this in Parsha.
Yeah.
Right? Esav, Nimrod, Ube Esav. I can only think about Nimrod and Esav. Those are the only people that come to mind when I look through the Torah and I think, who is called a hunter in the Torah? This is not the way of the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. How can you go ahead and kill and destroy life for no other reason other than rak ligmor chemdatsmano lisazik betzida, just so you could enjoy yourself for a few hours while you go out hunting? Yes, all animals, they were, from a theological standpoint, God created animals to serve man, and not like the story either. Someone who goes out and goes hunting, in the view of the Nobi Yehuda, he termed it as cruelty. And what's fascinating about it is that he says halakhically there's no issue, but something in his gut, you see over here, he doesn't cite any sources, but here in his gut, he says, there's something that just doesn't sit right with me. The only people who I know go hunting for pleasure, who go hunting for recreation, were Nimrod and Esav. And he can't understand, how could someone go out and try to snuff out life just for recreational purposes? That's Nodav Yehuda's approach. And this is, by the way, so anytime someone gives a class about killing, about guns, about violence, this source gets quoted in it. You'll see this source quoted. But the next source I'm going to share with you upends a lot of what we just saw. And it's really not exactly the opposite, but it's very much a fundamental counterpoint to a lot of what we read until this point. And this is the question that I referenced at the beginning of the class. Based on what we saw so far, if I asked you a question, if you just bought a new rifle, you went out to the store, you went to Walmart, or I'm not sure where you're able to get a rifle these days. I think accessibility changes over time. But you go to the rifle shop, and you just picked up a new Winchester or whatever rifle company you like to buy from. And do you make a Shechianim on that? When you buy a new suit, and you're really happy about that new suit, the first time you put it on, you make a blessing to God. You say, Shechianim v'kimanu v'igyanu lezman hazeh. Thank you, God, for bringing me to this time and for giving me such happiness by allowing me to acquire this new suit for Yom Tov, for the holiday. And one makes a Shechianu, the halacha is, one makes a Shechianu when they acquire something that gives them great joy. So the question is, if I purchase a rifle and it gives me great joy that I purchased that rifle, should I make a bracha? Should I make a blessing on purchasing that rifle? What would you say? Let me stop the share for a moment. Let's get some thumbs up if you think you should make a Shachianu. We got one. We have one brave man and a brave woman. Okay, David and Toby, we got one side over here. And how many people would say we should not make a Shachianu? Thumbs down for that. I see a lot of shaking heads. And I see, Marina says no. All right. Phyllis, that was a thumbs up. Do you mean thumbs down? Thumbs up. Okay. And then everyone else is undecided because everyone else knows, based on how I'm leading this class, that I'm about to pull out a source that's going to tell us otherwise, right? So you don't want to fall in for this trick. Dan says, I caught on to what you're saying, Moshe. Okay. So the final source I'm going to share over here, again, it's written by an Israeli author, Rav Shlomo Aviner, who's one of the great religious Zionistic halachic authorities. And so this is not translated. It's all in Hebrew. But let me translate for you because this is so important. So yes, Kim bin Yonenu, Enu Mavari Shechianu al Ha'ariga, Ela Adarabah al Gonashev Ekdach. When I make the blessing, he says, a Shechianu, I'm purchasing a new rifle. That's not a problem. Why? Because when I make the blessing of Shechianu on this rifle, I'm not making a Shechianu on the murder, on the killing that ensues, but I'm making this bracha on the protection that it provides. I don't make a bracha to thank God when I have to use that gun to destroy, to kill someone who's a threat to the Jewish community, to my country, but I am blessing God that I have this gun to protect me now. I think someone somehow drew over my screen. I'm not really sure how that happened. Umashi yesh lanu neshek, ena ma'or etzlenu atzvas. The fact now that the Jewish people are able to acquire and are able to own their own weapons, that does not evoke feelings of sadness. That does not create despondency. Shadayim yesh mochamos, because unfortunately, we still have many wars to fight. Ela adaraba, ma'orer simcha. It evokes happiness, joy, jubilation. Shezachinu lios amchofshi ba'artzenu, that we could be a free and independent people in our own homeland. Sheyesh lanu medina, that we have our own country, tzva mishtara, we have our own army, our own police force. Shekvar nena lemir masarishus agayim elani yochol lahagin atzmenu, something that the other nations, for all of these millennia, when we were not in our own country, when we were under the authority of other religions, other nations, other countries, and other people, we were not allowed to take up arms. We were not able to defend ourselves. Our lot, our fate was in the hands of whichever country, whichever people was ruling over us at the time. Now, do you think after these thousands of years, and now that we have had the War of Independence, and it's for the first time that the Jewish people as a collective are able to wield their own arms and are able to defend themselves, you think that's not a time to get up and dance in jubilation and celebrate the fact that we can bear arms as a Jewish people? Rather, it's a mitzvah. You should make a Shechianu on that. That simcha, that happiness from the War of Independence for Israel, continues until this very day. And therefore, when someone wears that rifle, I think it got cut off a little bit there. When someone wears that rifle for the first time, that rifle, it'll make a Shechianu on it. So, and you can imagine, so he also said earlier when it almost
done in his Israel, piece, right?
Just a moment. And therefore, in terms of carrying on Shabbos, he says, you don't have to worry about it. And these kind of weapons that we have are not celebrating the destruction, the fact that we're killing our enemies, but we're celebrating that we could defend ourselves on our own terms for the first time in Jewish history for so many years. L'chein, ein lasos hafrada bein haneshek lebein avodas Hashem. This is the important line. I mean, all this is important. This is all gold over here. He says, even if you don't agree with it, this is just like a collector's item of a source, just from an academic standpoint. L'chein, ein lasos hafrada bein haneshek lebein avodas Hashem. Therefore, one should not create a line between this weapon and between the service of God. If you're not using this weapon for the service of God, then you should have nothing to do with this weapon. But if you're using it, like Dina mentioned before, for Melchemes Nitzvah to defend to create a halachic Jewish state, then that is avodas Hashem, oz nikra lov shem Hashem. And therefore, then is not only appropriate, but commendable to invoke the name of God by making a blessing on receiving the rifle. And so what we're seeing nowadays in the state of Israel is this discussion. And you really, if you delve into the thought of religious Zionist thinkers and religious Zionist halachists who are more on the right, this is the kind of thinking. The gun doesn't represent murder and violence. It may have to come to that, God forbid, but what it represents is the independence and the autonomy, the authority, and the agency of the Jewish people to be able to govern their own destiny. And so what we went over time was from a weapon being viewed as a gnai, something disgusting, I want nothing to do with it, it's not an ornament, it's not a part of my clothing. How could David HaMelech wield that weapon? What happens is many of the religious Zionist rabbis who find themselves more to the right on the religious political spectrum are going to have to make the argument by looking through all the sources that we went through and that much more, and they're going to have to reinterprets a strong term, but they're going to have to engage and explain why in those sources it was problematic, why the rabbis didn't have such a positive view of weapons, of swords, and thereby guns, and why today it's different. So I want to put this out here, and I want to we have about 5 minutes left. I want to take your thoughts. Do you find this argument from Rav Aviner compelling based on the sources that we saw? Do you think that with a religious Zionist philosophy, one can make the argument and one could reconcile all the sources that we saw until now that had a very negative and at best tolerant approach to firearms and to weaponry in Jewish tradition? And by extension, how we understand the legacy, again, of the Maccabeim, how we understand the Maccabees. When we laud them as these military heroes, what are we lauding? It may be very similar to what we're seeing today in the modern state of Israel and how we view the Maccabees, how we portray the story of Hanukkah is a question that we're seeing nowadays through the lens of the modern state of Israel. And the only way to come to a somewhat appropriate conclusion is to engage with these sources that we saw this evening. So with that, I want to just open up the floor. If someone hasn't had a chance to ask a question yet, I'd like you to go first, but then otherwise we'll turn to our usual contributors.
I have a question.
I'm not sure why you laugh, Phyllis. All right.
Rabbi Kurtz.
Yes, who's speaking?
Rabbi Aviner saying that only people in Israel would say Shehecheyanu on a new firearm?
That's an interesting question for us as Americans, because his argument seems to be steeped in this idea of defending the country, defending the Jewish state. But I think what you're asking is a very natural extension, which is, well, what about us here in the United States? True, it's not a Jewish state, but one could extend that logic and extrapolate to America, where Jewish people have the same right to bear a firearm as our non-Jewish neighbors. And we have the ability to defend our own communities. Thank God we have good relationships with our police force, and they do everything they can to ensure our safety. But we have that agency today to defend ourselves the same way as any other American is able to. So if you're asking me to conjecture, I would say it's not a far jump. It's not far-fetched to extend that logic. But again, the philosophy behind it is not just Jews being able to defend themselves, but I think there definitely is a philosophy of nationalism that is motivating that psak as well. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good question. You know, what about us here in Stanford? Do we make the Shechianu? That's a good question. Alech lemaisa. I guess anyone buys a rifle sometime soon, you'll come to Rabbi Cohen or myself, and we'll get you the answer on that. I defer to Rabbi Cohen, by the way. You don't need an answer on the spot. It's fine. Anyway, any other questions or haaros, any contributions, anything that you want to argue on, disagree with? Merrill G. Gordon.
It's David that's going to ask the question. I have an issue with the concept or the rabbi's logic, where you said he reached the conclusion that halacha didn't prevent hunting for sport because it gave pleasure to the person. Because I could reach the same conclusion that torturing an animal, okay, might give some person pleasure. That's why they do it. But that's not permissible. So how does one reach the conclusion that if something gives the person pleasure, there are plenty of things we're not permitted to do that give us pleasure. Mm-hmm. Why killing an animal is that appropriate?
So that's a great question. And that distinction could be clear, but it begins to be fleshed out by Rabbi Vadi Yosef when it comes to the geese, the faux gras, or whatever Phyllis always corrects me on, and Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva when it comes to veal, to force feeding these young calves, and where he tries to make that argument, the distinction that you're bringing up, there's a difference between some minor pain for our benefit versus just full out torturing them for almost no benefit. The cost-benefit analysis makes no sense. So I would think that there is a similar line to be drawn here. Now, when one goes hunting, my understanding, again, I don't, you know, my grandfather, who, some of you saw him in the neighborhood recently, he comes in with the NRA life member jacket on. So, you know, he's definitely had more experience with a rifle and hunting than I do. But for myself, who doesn't have as much experience with a firearm, I've only shot like a 22 rifle when I was in Camp Mosheva for a summer. Because again, they're, you know, I guess they're trying to train you to be like IDF soldiers already. So my understanding is that if you're a good marksman, you shoot the animal, it should be killed on the spot or close to on the spot. So I think, though, you're right, that if perhaps if the note of Yehuda did receive a question of, I like torturing the animal for a long period of time to give me that pleasure, he might draw the line there. Now, I agree with your question, which is, well, I understand there's a difference between torture and immediate death in our mind, but is there a clear halakhic criterion for making that definition? So I agree with you, that requires further clarification.
Hi, Rabbi, this is Stephen Lesser. I wanted to ask about...
Stephen, I got to cut you off for a moment, sorry. Okay. It's 9:00 now, so if anyone needs to log off, you're welcome to log off. I will stay on for a few more minutes to answer any remaining questions. Thank you all for joining. Stephen.
If the prevailing view, or at least an important view, is that a rifle is such a schus, then I'm not sure exactly where this ends. You know, Allah has kama v'kama. Maybe we should dance to horror every time we see a tank coming down, or declare a national holiday when Israel receives F-22s. I mean, is there, are we saying that weaponry as a category is something that we should take pride in, or is it restricted just to rifles?
So let me address both sides of that question. That's a good question, which is Ein L'Dabar Sof. You know, every time Israel buys fighter jets from the U.S., does that mean we have to dance the hora and make a national holiday out of it? So, I mean, that's another shir we'll do closer to Yom HaTzmaut, which is whether one's allowed to make a new Jewish holiday. But we'll leave that for another time. But to your point, Shechianu is a very specific halakhic question, which is, when I buy a new item for myself, do I make a bracha? So if I, Moshe Kurtz, bought a new fighter jet for myself, it'd be the same answer, I think, as a rifle. They'd be categorically similar. But that obligation is on the individual. The state of Israel doesn't have this concept of having an obligation or an imperative to make a Shechianu bracha when it purchases new items. Also, I would say, if you are constantly, like if you are in the weapons business and you're just always buying rifles, or if you're just a big rifle aficionado and another rifle in your collection doesn't give you the same joy as that first one you purchased, then you wouldn't be making a Shechianu on it either. That's why if I buy a new tie, I don't make a bracha on it. But if I get a nice new suit, which I don't get so frequently, then that I would make a bracha on, because there's a subjective element to it as well. Does that address your point, Stephen?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, great. But we could always dance the hora for next time there's a new peace deal with Israel. Why not? All right.
Rabbi, I have a question. Since we've had such violence in churches and synagogues, and the question is whether one should be able to carry a gun inside for purposes of protection, it's not in the land of Israel. We're here. How do you see that?
Right. So I want to just clarify that it's a great question, Susan, and it's a practical question, unfortunately. I cannot make any policy decisions here on the spot. I'll be reticent to do that. But I think that is the huge discussion that many shuls have had, especially, unfortunately, after the church shootings and unfortunately after the shul shooting that we had in Pittsburgh. It's unfortunately not only a, you know, interesting academic topic for us to come on a Monday evening and discuss, but I just want to validate and acknowledge your point that this should be a serious discussion for the Jewish community, which is how do we balance keeping the shul as a sanctuary and the safety of the shul? What does that mean for having firearms? You know, it could be dangerous if anyone, you know, Isha Yashar Ben Avyasa, each person you just come in with their own firearm and we don't even know about it. On the other hand, if there's no security with no firearms and someone comes up armed, then we're not defended at all. That's why we have an armed security guard on Shabbos mornings. So I can't give you any specific policy decisions because that's not my place to do that. But I think it's a very valid conversation that would come out from these sources. So I'm glad that you're going in that direction, Susan. I think I saw David. Did you have a question before? No. Okay. So from the Stephen Lesser side.
Hi, my name's Sarah. On that question of bringing the firearms into shul, what you said actually made me think of something. That separation where King David couldn't build the temple because of his involvement with war. Would somebody carrying a firearm, even if it's for the protection of the community, still be able to be called up for an aliyah?
Ah, very good.
So, I mean, is there that separation of the war item and the spiritual item?
Absolutely. And that I'm glad you're circling back to that topic. So I think that's very relevant to the passage. I know we glossed over it quickly, so I'm glad you're bringing me back to it. That source in the Shulchan Aruch, which says they shouldn't come with a sakin aruch magulai, with a long sword that everyone can see, that's problematic, not even if you're forgetting an aliyah, but just for being a congregant, any person davening in shul, it's not appropriate. So certainly to get an aliyah to the Torah, one would have to take the suggestions given of either covering the weapon or putting down the weapon somewhere else. Again, if one is in a hot spot where they need that gun to defend themselves, they are actually worried about an imminent threat, and you're the only person with that firearm, and you're the only one standing between the people in shul and a potential attack, then the Tzitz Eliezer said, you keep that gun with you. And I think that speaks to the point from Rav Aviner that even according to him, it's almost a badge of pride that the Jewish people are able to defend themselves. But of course, I just want to emphasize that whatever the synagogue policy is, we all consult with experts to figure out what makes the most sense for safety. So of course, always consult with the synagogue president, board, and staff before you make any of those decisions. Okay, very good. Always consult your local modern-Orthodox rabbi, as I always like to say. All right, great. I have to jump off. I have a few other things to deal with tonight. So, Yasher Koch, thank you again, everyone, for joining.
Thank you,
good to see some new people.
Thank you.
Oh, Rabbi Cohen, thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to thank you on behalf of the show, Yasher Koch, a very fascinating, important share, and Hatzlacha Rabbah. Thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye-bye.